on that cutting edge going forward. Prioritization of long-range precision strike that is conventional in nature, long-range missiles that are conventional in nature. Madeline has mentioned that. And developing and fielding homeland integrated air and missile defense that can deter and defeat coercive attacks by Russia and China, as well as continue to be able to deter North Korea from striking the continental United States. So these are some of the non-nuclear areas that we were also very focused on, as well as just the bread and butter of what we need to do to keep our aircraft flying. For example, again, Madeline mentioned modernization and upgrading of the tanker fleet. So just a few additional points I wanted to really foot stomp some of the messages that have already come out from the chair and vice chair. But with that, over to you.
This is the Commonwealth Club radio program. Thanks for joining us for a report on U.S. national security, featuring Dr. Madeline Creedon, Senator John Kyle, Ambassador Rose Gottemuller, and me, Gloria Duffy. You can get the inside scoop on the Commonwealth Club of California, our events, our travel program, and more by subscribing to our email newsletter at commonwealthclub.org/email. Now, back to our program. Thank you very much, Rose. I'm going to take just a moment putting on my hat as a commission member and then returning to my hat as the moderator. Just a word about the commission. 12 members, all have served in government but are not currently serving in government. Evenly divided, bipartisan, 6 notional Democrats, 6 notional Republicans. Appointed by congressional leaders, the Armed Services Committees of both houses, and other congressional leaders like majority and minority leaders. I happen to be the appointee of our friend Nancy Pelosi when she was a majority leader, a broadly cast group. And we started from very different perspectives, I think, but it is a consensus report. After taking a look at the intelligence and the information and the magnitude of the changes since the prior and recommendations. A very few additional words. In the national security field, we often say that a threat is a combination of intentions and capabilities. So we have seen a major change since the 1990s in the threats we face that are combinations of the intentions and capabilities of other major powers. So Russia has been modernizing its military capabilities and has been engaging in a brutal, unprovoked, and inexcusable war in Ukraine. That is the combination of the capabilities and what we read as intentions towards other countries by Russia. In China, it's been referred to their dramatic buildup. China is on a program to add 1,000 strategic nuclear weapons by about 2035 or so. But as John said, they tend to meet their goals faster than they set them out. So we have two authoritarian countries with designs on their neighbors. China has been talking about repatriating Taiwan, even by a certain date. We also have protestations of collaboration between Russia and China, of their undying friendship and so on, and also increasing threats from North Korea and Iran. So these combinations of capabilities and intentions have changed the environment from the U.S. My last service in government was in a thankful, wonderful role I was able to play, helping to get rid of about 7,000 nuclear weapons in the former Soviet Union through what was called the Nunn-Lugar program, together with my colleagues here. That was a unique point in time when the doors were open with Russia in particular, and Ukraine and Belarus and Kazakhstan, to get rid of a number of their nuclear weapons that had been targeted against us. It is a very changed environment today. We must, above everything, protect ourselves. We have to have an effective deterrent. And the changes in numbers of nuclear weapons facing us make that a different proposition today than it has been in the future. And hence, sizing our nuclear force or deploying it or targeting it, whatever, in a way that continues to ensure our deterrence, ensures that our values and our allies and our interests in the world are protected in a way that we can continue to maintain a system that is different from the more authoritarian systems that we see as adversaries. I will say we looked at potential for arms control as part of this survey, and we did make a proposal. We found one technology called fractional orbital bombardment systems that the Chinese have been pursuing to be something we felt perhaps we, Russia, China, could all agree on to have a ban on this type of technology. So we did propose seeking such a ban. We also proposed in our report to have the U.S. intelligence community do more work on figuring out why the Chinese are adding so many strategic nuclear weapons so rapidly. What's the goal there? Final note, it seems to me and it seemed to us that it will be a while until we are able to get any productive, more collaborative discussions going with Russia, having to do with leadership in Russia. With China, perhaps there are possibilities still, as exemplified by the meetings that took place around APEC here, not only between President Xi and Biden, but also between the Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control and Verification, Mallory Stewart, and her counterpart on the Chinese side, where they discussed arms control and nonproliferation. We have lots of questions. Well, let's start with a rather general one, and fellow commissioners, feel free to take a stab, anyone who would like to. What are the major political or other roadblocks to proceeding with the proposed plan by the commission?
It's a very good question. You are all aware, because you read the newspaper and follow the news on TV, of the machinations that the Congress is going through right now to do lots of different things, but at the center of it is trying to fund the government for another year. And at the center of that is both the authorization bill for the Defense Department and the various appropriation bills that fund the programs that we're talking about here. Getting Congress to pass those bills and to do so in a sensible way will be very difficult because this isn't something their constituents care about. And also because they've got some internal partisan issues going back and forth. They've also fallen into some very bad habits of not getting their work done on time, namely getting appropriations bills passed, as a result of which everything piles up at the end of the year, and their only realistic alternative usually is to ball it up into a great big omnibus appropriation bill on a Tuesday night and send it to the respective houses for passage by Thursday. Well, this does not please the rank and file, as you can imagine, and it makes for a very bad legislating. They usually can't quite get all that done quickly, so they just kick the can down the road for a couple months with a continuing resolution, which is, well, we'll just keep spending the money we spent last year on the same things we funded last year until we figure out this new thing. And that goes on for a while. Now, you're a defense contractor, and you're supposed to bid on contracts to give the Defense Department what they want. How do you plan in this environment? You can't. You have to hire real people, and you have to have real warehouse space or manufacturing space and so on. It's really hard the way that the Congress and the Pentagon do business for our private sector to get in the game and help out here. They want to, but it's hard. So there are a lot of reforms throughout our government that need to occur. And this is another reason we talk about a whole of government approach. Let's see, I guess both of you had made the point earlier, and Gloria and Madeline, that it starts with a conversation with the American people.
How does a three-peer scenario differ from two-peer scenario? How does this change how we must strategically position ourselves?
I think I'll take it in a little bit different direction. So in your own personal relationships, very often it's much easier to have a one-on-one relationship. Well, in dealing with countries, it's often easier to have a bilateral relationship, have a one-on-one relationship. When you introduce a third party, you've totally changed the dynamic. So agreements, customs between the two, ways to resolve issues over time between the two. Now you have a third party in the mix. So it really does change the dynamic. It changes how each party thinks about the other two parties. It changes how one party may decide to align with another party in a way that is new. For us, in a deterrence perspective, it changes how we think about what we need. So when we were mostly focused on Russia, we had a better sense of what we needed to deter conventional war. Now that China is in the mix, it makes it harder. We have to come to a different conclusion because the theaters are very different, obviously require different things. The European theater is more land-based. The Asia-Pacific theater is more sea-based. It's more ships. They're just very different. So we have to not replicate things, but we have to think about, well, what does this theater need? What does this theater need? And also we have to think about, what if they collaborate? What if they do something together, or what if they do something sequentially? What if there's an opportunity for aggression when one occupies us over here and the other then comes in for this opportunistic approach? It's very different. And so I'll just say, in the same way that a relationship with two people is very different from a relationship with three people.
And just to add very briefly to that, we also have very different alliance relationships mm-hmm. in the two theaters, with the NATO alliance, obviously now 31 countries, and been very coherent, in my view, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine a year ago, February. But that's very different from our very good allies in Asia, ROK, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, far-flung allies in some cases, but also allies that we are dealing with more on a bilateral, parallel basis rather than everybody working together in quite the same way that the NATO alliance works. So it's different. But I do want to underscore the point of the report about the importance of our alliance relationships and how they are a force multiplier for the United States in so many ways, because that was a very fundamental recommendation, finding and recommendation among the those in the report.
Thank you. I get the sense that the U.S. alone will not adequately deter Russia, China, Iran in the future. Does this commission engage the EU and the collective West in working toward broader combining capability and creating broader collective nuclear deterrence?
Well, it's exactly what Rose just talked about.
Deterrence relationship. And we do talk about the necessity of looking at non-strategic nuclear capabilities and thinking anew about how we extend nuclear deterrence to our allies, again, both in Europe and in Asia. In Europe, we have the long-standing extended deterrent mission, where we have deployed some warheads in Europe, and the NATO allies cooperate with us on delivery in the horrible case that it would ever have to happen. But we work very closely together there. The situation is much different in Asia, and I think that there will have to be a lot of thought going into how we continue to bolster extended deterrence in Asia. I thought the president and his agreement with the ROK president last May to establish this enhanced cooperation between ROK and U.S. on the extended deterrence relationship there was very powerful, and I think we'll have to see more of that occurring in Asia.
Another question about allies. If South Korea and Japan were given the money, could that increase U.S. naval capabilities faster and cheaper than having all the work done in the USA? Is this inaction a strategic risk, or for congressional members, a risk worth taking to keep jobs in the USA?
I mean, it is important that we expand these relationships with our allies, and that we also have an obligation to look to our allies for more than what they do now, and they have an obligation to us to demand greater cooperation. So we have to expand our cooperation with them. And when I say that, I don't just mean what we often think about and just having our allies buy more American things, but we also have to utilize their capabilities, their industrial base, utilize their technical skills, do joint development work, do joint production work. There are some very good programs right now in the missile defense arena, right, where we're doing joint development and joint production with Japan.
Yep.
We need to do more of that. Space is a great opportunity where we can do joint work. Well, we have a lot of things going on with Australia where we have joint satellite development programs, and also where we have joint situational awareness. The Australians have some very good capabilities on the ground to help with greater understanding of what's going on in space, the space situational awareness. So we have to expand all of these capabilities, and some of our allies are doing really well in terms of their contributions, and others, frankly, need to do a little more.
And it's complicated because a sovereign country does what's best for it, and that isn't always what's best for everybody else. So you can't necessarily say, well, the United States can solve some of our deterrent problems by shoving it over onto an ally. A good example here, we're having, I'll state it differently. There is some disagreement about what would be best for Taiwan to deter China from ever trying to attack it. Countries sometimes like to buy shiny objects to show off to their folks that nobody ever sees, you know, just for example. So it's fine to have allies. I mean, it's more than fine. It's necessary, and it's one of our strengths because we've got allies and these other, our adversaries really don't, except their little tight group among themselves. It's not necessarily a one-for-one force multiplier. You've got to work with them to coordinate what everybody is producing, make sure it works together, make sure they can deploy things together, and that everybody's pulling in the same direction if you're going to rely upon other countries, for example, as NATO partners.
Why weren't we prepared for the rise of China? Seems like a massive oversight from intelligence.
I think the business community in the United States and to some extent the political community was so enamored with the prospect of making a lot of money off of a 1 billion plus market of Chinese folks that we were willing to overlook for years a lot of intellectual theft and other practices by China that in ordinary circumstances would not be considered friendly at all. Moreover, nobody likes to think about war or preparation for war. To me, it was, I mean, I was there at the time. I went through the debates about should we let China into the WTO? Well, they're just going to disrupt things. They'll never comply with the WTO court rulings and so on. Well, no, we need them in there because if they're in the tent, then they'll have to cooperate with the rest of us. Besides that, we can all make a lot of money. There's a lot of hope involved in all of this. And sometimes it's not realistic. Sometimes it pans out.
How did the 2024 presidential candidates, some who are state governors, become aware of your report? Aides reading and summarizing is not as effective as hearing as we are tonight directly from commission members. Let me pose that to our person with a long elected history.
We focused on trying to get the message out, but the reality is we only had so much bandwidth as 12 people. We spent a lot of time trying to answer the question. In fact, there's an entire chapter in the report about what's at stake here? Why do we care about this? And therefore, why should the American people care about it? And part of that discussion related to our obligation in the world. Why do we have an obligation? Why aren't we isolationist? It's been a component of one political party, and there is rapidly developing an equally boisterous component of the other political party that says we don't have to worry about what's going on abroad. We don't need to give any help to Ukraine, for example. That's not our fight. Let's solve our own border first and not worry about their border. You've heard all the arguments. Opposition that the United States of America has a critical role to play globally, and that if we don't do it, things can fall apart very, very quickly. Yes, that puts more responsibility on us. It may cost our taxpayers more money. Kind of like that old ad, pay me now or pay me later. If the country that can do something about this doesn't take the lead, bring allies and others along and spend what it takes to provide deterrence, aggressors will be tempted around the world. And eventually it'll be a lot worse than it is today. So we take a position on that debate that's occurring in Congress today. Are you more isolationist or more interventionist? And we, as 12, say we don't have any option, alternative, but to continue to play the global role that we have in the past.
And we really emphasize the message that deterrence is cheaper than fighting the war.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Apart from Taiwan and the resources of the South China Sea, what is the threat from China?
Two things. First of all, a country doesn't go from almost nothing to a peer nuclear adversary overnight for nothing. Why are they doing what they're doing? We did ask the intelligence community try to get a little more granularity in that. But the obvious answer generally is so that they will have more capability to do what they want to do without interference from the United States. That's why you have a big nuclear component to your defense establishment. They view themselves as the rising power of the future, and we're the past. And Xi himself personally has spoken and written a lot about the fact that it's about time, and this is not characteristic for a Chinese leader, by the way, but he believes it's about time that China step forward and take its proper role in the world. And that proper role is to be the big dominator, starting with domination within its region. And then you add to that the deficiency that all authoritarian governments have. They don't have the check and balance of their people or others around the world who they listen to. Whatever they want, that's what they're going to get. That's the way their government is structured. Their historic burr under the saddle, which is Taiwan, and their absolute determination to bring Taiwan under Chinese Communist Party control one way or the other. And they're very clear about including by force if necessary. I know the question was other than that, but that's kind of like other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like to play? This is a big deal and could start World War III. So you put all of that together, and it's just something we didn't want to have to worry about it, but we've got no choice now.
Do current treaties limit or prevent the numbers of weapons required to add deterrent capability to deal with China's threat?
There are no treaties with China. That's one of the problems. There are no treaties with China. I mean, there have been efforts, certainly in context with, say, the P5, to try to set up norms. The U.S. has made a proposal that, for instance, ban on testing kinetic ASAT weapons that would create debris in space. We put that out there. Obviously, China has done that. Russia has done that. It has terrible long-term effects for but there are none, and that's really the problem.
Does anybody want to say anything about the status of arms control agreements more generally?
Well, let me just mention that, in fact, the new START treaty, which continues in force and will continue in force until 2026, U.S. and Russia side, and a total on each side, U.S. and Russia, each about 4,000, 4,500 warheads. So China is building up fast, and the threat is before us. So I don't want to shortchange that at all. But for the moment, the agreement between the United States and Russia, the limits of New START, do not prevent us from continuing to deter China at the moment. It's this phased approach that I wanted to stress once again. We are worried not about today necessarily, but we are worried what we see coming in 2030, 2035, and that's what we have to pay attention to. So at the moment, the limits of the New START treaty are there still. Sadly, the Russians ceased implementing the treaty last February with Putin saying, you stop your assistance to Ukraine and then we'll return to implementing the new START treaty. Well, the administration quite rightly said, you cannot try to leverage us by threatening us about the new START treaty. Both U.S. and Russia are committed to maintaining the limits of new START, but sadly, at the moment, we don't have the implementation measures like on-site verification and exchanges of information, databases, notifications, and so forth. So it's a real problem, but it's a problem of Russia's making. I do agree that we're in dire straits at the moment with regard to nuclear arms control, but let's see what the future may bring.
Last question, and I'm going to ask for an answer from each person. What did you learn from being on this commission that surprised you the most? Okay. Madeline, go ahead.
That you could actually reach consensus with 12 very disparate, I often refer to us as eclectic, views. I really was not convinced we were going to get there.
You know the first paragraph of Tolstoy's novel, Anna Karenina, when I'm paraphrasing here, but he says, each family is unhappy in its own way. And we are like one big family, each of us unhappy in his or her own way, but we are a family and we have this consensus to show for it. And to me, that was the biggest surprise, that in this disparate group of 12 very, very different people, we could end up, through months of deep discussions and intense debate, we could end up, at least I feel like, mm-hmm. these guys are somewhat my family, so they may not claim me, but nevertheless, that was my surprise.
I never had any doubt that we would come together, but I think in retrospect, the thing that really bothers me, and I probably should have realized it, but what sort of surprised me is, you know, in the past, we've relied upon our great capacity as a country to build up our industrial base, to our military before World War II was the 17th largest in the world. And just in a matter of months, really, the United States, with its great industrial might, began to outproduce our enemies in a way that just made it inevitable that we were going to win both in the European and Pacific theater. And you look at the state of our industrial military base today, and our scientific community, and our workforce skills, and all the rest of it, and China is way better than we are at this. And Russia, with its command economy, can get the job done on its own, too. Despite all the conversations we had with all the experts in government, I am not confident that any of them has an answer to this question. How are we going to get all this stuff done on time? They have a great can-do attitude, which I really love about particularly our military. You give them an order, and by golly, they'll say they're going to do it. But saying they're going to do it and figuring out a way to do it in today's environment is going to be really, really hard. It's going to take the American people somehow giving that support and funding it through the congressional appropriations and seeing the battle as a long-term battle. And there's nothing really more important for the United States government to do than to prevent nuclear war. So, gotta do it.
I would like to thank John Kyle, Madeline Creedon, Rose Gottemuller.
Wait a minute, you're ducking the question.
Well, yes.
I would subscribe to both of those themes. The collaboration and consensus was very important on the commission. I, too, was surprised by the way that workforce issues and supply chain issues are affecting our defense effort. Whatever we see in the economy more generally, we see magnified in the very specialized areas in the defense industry. So that is a major problem, to compete with the exciting civilian technology economy we see so vibrant here in the Bay Area. Our defense efforts, the companies, the national labs, the production facilities are all losing out to the exciting civilian economy in attracting workforce and having the supplies and the commodities and the manufacturing capability to do their job. So thank you so much to our panel. Thank you so much to our audience here in San Francisco, to those who are participating online. I wish us all well in meeting this challenge. Thank you for joining us for the latest episode of the Commonwealth Club radio program. Today you heard from Dr. Madeline Creedon, Senator John Kyle, Ambassador Rose Gottemuller, and me, Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Club. Join us again next week to hear Jason Rantz discuss the politics of urban problems. Until then, you can learn more about us and our events at commonwealthclub.org. Find thousands of our programs on Apple Podcasts, Audible, and YouTube. And when you're in the Bay Area, we'd love to welcome you in person to the Commonwealth Club of California. To hear the entire hour-long version of these conversations, download the program from the club's website or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Jazzy 93.7. KJZY, Sebastopol.
Thanks for bringing me along with the Dave Koz Radio Show for your weekend. Now in our 30th year on the air, and we owe it all to you. For our first program of 2024, joining us will be one of the world's most recorded bassists, with over 2,000 album credits. 2,000. And he can be heard on several Grammy-winning songs as well. He even holds the congressional records for his contributions to the worldwide music community. He's that good. He is one busy guy, and we're very excited that he'll be spending the next couple of hours with us. Bassist extraordinaire Nathan East is our very special in-studio guest to kick off this new year.